Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
Hello, my iridescent jellyfishes. How are you doing? We are so glad you're here. Today, we're going to talk to you about gender, feminism, and fashion. Now, I'm old enough to remember when being interested in fashion made you a ditzy airhead. But as I've grown up, I've become interested in learning more about the intersection of fashion and feminism and gender. But first, introductions. I am Natalia, whose style is giving you sweatshirt chic because I live in a place with seasons now, but also flip-flops because I'm a Floridian till I die vibes.
And I'm Lucy, whose style is more camp counselor meets your dad from the 80s, but that dad is having a sexuality crisis and is thinking about leaving your mom currently.
That's it, guys. That's the episode.
That's the episode.
This is where we end it all.
Join Minnesota Public Radio News in partnership with Twin Cities Diversity in Practice for a panel discussion with community experts on how BIPOC and white Minnesotans are navigating conversations around race, how we're experiencing the trial of George Floyd's killer, Derek Chauvin, and how we can move forward as neighbors. Tune in Wednesday, March 31st at noon. Register now to reserve your free spot at nprevents.org. That's nprevents.org.
I do tend to steal a show with that.
It's a 10 out of 10, babe. It's a 10 out of 10.
Thank you.
All right. So on that note, I guess let's get started. Why are we talking about fashion? Because fashion is more than a garment. To quote Britain's Fashion Council chief executive, Caroline Rush, each individual or group's personal style is a form of empowerment. Clothes are as much a personal preference of style, color, and shape as they are an armor and a protective layer. And I don't know about you, Lucy, but I kind of really believe that.
The phrase, especially the protective layer, that's really like, I don't know, reading that, I'm like, yes, it is. It's not only like a statement piece, but it's also... it's like it feels protective, and not just in the way where it's like you're naked without the clothes, but it's like emotionally protective.
Absolutely. And I think that that's where we'll touch on it later. But I think that it's such an important piece when we think about women and non-gender conforming icons and how the cis het male gaze has made clothing a weapon to be used against people. And what does that mean when they take away that protective layer?
Yeah.
So to segue onto that, I think it's real easy to say that fashion doesn't matter when it's typically reserved for the feminine, quote unquote, whatever that means, or non-cisgendered male among us. But then what are we saying about other folks by extension? You know, it's saying that we don't matter. And that's some bullshit. So if you think about fashion, I think holistically, the very production of fashion is guided by women. The ideas, the design, the influence is typically a female-led enterprise. The production is steeped in imperialism and slavery. Where do you think cotton comes from? You know?
Yeah.
How did cotton get from the Western Hemisphere back over to
here, where it's just being implemented into this huge industrialized complex?
Precisely. Yes. And also silk. You think about silk.
Yeah.
China and, you know, how that traveled the actual Silk Road, which is a real thing. And then we also have to think about how fashion practices and the fashion industry tends to exploit women, usually brown women, disproportionately. So to say that fashion isn't able to be looked at through a feminist lens and through an intersectional feminist lens is to have a real lazy view of what fashion is, I think.
Yes. It's ignoring the production behind the presentation.
Absolutely.
Bullshit.
Absolutely.
Some bullshit.
Just retweet. That's it, guys.
Retweet.
Yeah. In terms of feminist theory, and I am just looking at this quote that I'm going to say is just from a cis view of feminist theory. I'm going to leave it to our resident non-binary icon, Lucy, to talk about some queer critiques of fashion. But in the feminist world, feminist interventions and discussions of fashion have most often been from the vantage of a defensive critic, right? And this is what I was alluding to in my introduction, where being interested in fashion makes you somehow a person less likely to be taken seriously.
Yes.
And if you're interested in fashion, that means that you cannot support feminist ideals, because the very act of engaging in fashion industry, the fashion world, is performative and is nothing but entrenching the view of the male gaze. And what we should really be doing, in very large capital letters, is rejecting the male gaze in everything that we do.
And it's turned to this culture of like, well, love yourself, accept yourself. Like, you don't need to put makeup on for others, which, like, that's a whole other conversation that ties into this aspect. But it's like,
I'll have you know, I don't wear makeup because I don't know how to wear makeup.
Because I don't
know
how to put it on my face, actually. Check there. But it's like, it's ignoring the fact that you can do this for yourself outside of this desire. And it's just, you're stamped on this label of like, oh, you can only care about one thing without caring about another,
which is so stupid. I mean, yeah, obviously I think listeners of this podcast will know that it's stupid, but it's a real disappointment, I think, to be limited in such a way. Like, why can't we carry nuanced thoughts? I contain multitude.
I contain multitudes.
I do not exist solely to do one thing, and that one thing is just like pick out a fucking fly ass top. So anywho, that's neither here nor there. Talk to me about whether or not fashion can be feminist.
Absolutely. And I think that does tie in really well from your earlier point about this male gaze that then gets brought in, where when we talk about feminism and fashion, it's kind of like, I feel like a lot of people go to this starting point of like the t-shirts that say like the future is female. And it's like, okay, that's a great starting point, but also there's a lot more complexities that come from that. And women and non-binary folks are often taught to be viewed under this male gaze. And when we change our style and we challenge that viewpoint that we've been taught to perform for someone else, we begin to question who that presentation is for. And that inherently in itself is a feminist act, when you are questioning, well, what is this presentation for? And that's oftentimes how I view fashion in a feminist lens for myself, being non-binary, being very recently exploring how fashion is tied to my gender identity. And, you know, it's, we all know that like there's no way to dress gay and there's no way to dress a certain way, but also it is very rooted in that identity, where presentation does matter to some extent. And it's like, it's queering the gender presentation for me that does make it in a way that's like, well, I'm challenging the male gaze by queering my presentation and that fashion, where it's like, I'm not existing for a man to look at me. I'm existing to challenge how you're looking at me.
And in that, as part of that questioning the presentation, does that leave room for you to almost question it for yourself as well? Like, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, so you have internalized ideas of what you are supposed to look like. And I say supposed to is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence.
Right. Yeah.
But does by queering your presentation and by queering your fashion, does that allow you to then kind of shed those expectations and take that internal gaze off yourself? Not just the external male gaze, but that internal Lucy gaze.
I think so, because there's a lot going on in my head all the time. And that's
like
not
one of my favorite heads on earth though, people. So,
oh, you stop that. But that's, again, not like, that's not a unique experience. Like, of course there's a lot going on up here, but it gives this you know, it's like people who are interested in art. Like we do, people do art to offload all of these different emotions and all these different feelings, and offloading that internal gaze I have of myself through queering that fashion. Holy shit, it's like a weight off your shoulders. It's like exploring with these different ways that I can present myself, where it silences that voice that always is like circling through the identity, where it's like it's coming out and this is for me. This is my brain coming out and vomiting all over myself in a cute way. So yes, I definitely think it's like it's an internal and an external thing.
I wish I could make that the title of this episode. It's my brain's vomiting out all of those
brains vomiting down the front of me, but in a cute way.
Oh, bless it. So you bring up an interesting point as of fashion as art and subject to the same critiques as art, because I think that we inherently would not think of fashion as art. As I've delved deeper into the theory of design and like how collections get made, and listening to designers explain their thought process, it really is just a fiber arts piece that you get to wear.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've ever thought about it that way. The idea that I am a walking work of art.
Hell yes, you are.
But that I get to then make myself a billboard and an art piece that can be critiqued and that can be evaluated through that kind of lens. I love this journey for us right now.
We are exploring so much. I'm going to dress up in such a cute little outfit tomorrow. Or maybe I won't, because I'm not going to confine myself to that.
But no. Take your art wherever it takes you.
Yes. We are walking billboards of art meant to be.
Yeah. Of our own brain art.
Of our own making.
So I think that also takes me to the next point, which is think about stereotypes in fashion and what that does for, oh gosh. Thinking about, so this episode is recording on Thursday, March 18th, which is the day after the deadly shooting in Atlanta, Georgia, where some fucktwit decided to commit a hate crime against Asian women. And I think that we would be remiss if we did not, one, state our ride or die support of the AAPI community, and two, think about how stereotypes in fashion also lead to real life fucking consequences.
Yes.
Right. So you've got the stereotype of a submission Asian woman who is on the same fucking wavelength, hypersexualized, while simultaneously being infantilized.
Yeah.
And that's the ideal, and that's who you're supposed to be. And with that comes personality traits and ideas of what women should act like, that when are challenged are just, it's problematic for these jackholes who only want to see Asian women in this way. You have the elderly Asian grandma that you go to for wisdom and like her tracksuit and her see-through visor. And those are the only ways that Asian women can exist.
Yes. And they're confined to those presentations.
And you are denying the beauty of these different art pieces, which are people.
Yeah. And complete lived experiences.
Yeah. It's just so annoying. And then I can say that too, as a Latina woman, it gets exhausting, because I can exist as the sensual Latina woman, a la Sofia Vergara, with my beautiful bodycon dresses and my mermaid hair and my, again, hypersexualized appearance, or I can disappear completely and be a maid.
Yeah.
And those are the only two ways in which I can exist, because I can count on several hands, not all of them mine, the number of times where people have been like, well, you don't really dress like I thought a Latina would. What do you want me to wear, guy? Like a fucking flag?
What the fuck?
What are you looking for? And that was when I was younger. So imagine what that does to you.
Yeah. Again, bringing in that like infantilized portion where it's like being ingrained into you from such a young age. You're like, I'm supposed to be sexualizing my body through my presentation for you to consume, or I have no point.
No me gusta. Or you don't exist.
You don't exist.
Because what are maids for? To live in the background. They are not meant to be main actors or main characters in any plot. So it is disingenuous for people to say that fashion and feminism are not intertwined in some way, I think, is the general point. If nothing else, if you get nothing else from this episode, besides brain barf, like that's
besides
the thing.
Brain barf.
Is that fashion is inherently a feminist exploration.
Yeah.
I would like to bring this up. I'd like to bring this to the group, aka you, Lucy.
To the group, me.
I read an article in the Toronto Sun by Leanne DeLapp.
Tell me about it.
There remain deep hangups around what feminist fashion even is. Is it supporting women-led brands? Is it buying less? Is it addressing difficult subjects with words on our chests? And I stopped. I copied that in my notes. And then I wrote a whole dissertation about it. But first, what do you think about those questions, Lucy?
Well, kind of like, you know, it's kind of like stepping into feminism for the first time where, you know, you hear about feminism for the first time and you're like, ooh, what a spicy new term. And yes, women have periods and we bleed. And oh my God, it is so liberating to be like, I also put a tampon up my vagina. Like, great, great first step for feminism. Don't stop there. Like, let's keep pushing. Let's nudge like to the fact that like not all women have periods or not all people who have periods are women. Like it's nudging that first great thought just a little further.
I think the thing that depressed me the most and the thing that I started with in my notes was that this would be a great start for an article written in 1970.
Yeah.
But it was written in 2020.
Oof.
And we 100% need to dig deeper.
Yes.
And I think that, oh God, there, you have to look at it from an intersectional lens. You just can't stop at, is it supporting women-led brands? Like that's some basic bullshit.
Yeah.
Not all women are feminists and not all feminists are women. Like,
no,
the existence of the binary is just so exhausting in every aspect of life. Everything cannot be neatly divided into. And I think that if I was asking questions, my questions are, what systems are we supporting that exploit labor, which is usually women who are women of color in marginalized community making these clothes? How are we supporting their exploitation with our purchases? How are we supporting companies who exploit entire nations for our consumption in the Western world, specifically in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
What communities are we marginalizing based on how they present to the world? Her question and the larger article didn't even touch on queer fashion or queer, like, anything.
Yeah.
Why? It's 2020. Why are we excluding? Why are we marginalizing people with our conversations about something like fashion?
Mm-hmm.
And this will definitely be another episode. Lucy and I have already penciled it in, folks. So stay tuned for April. But what ecological harms are we causing with our consumption of things like fast fashion,
mm-hmm,
generally, right? And what communities are bearing the brunt of that harm?
Yes.
Because, mm-hmm, when you think about, I know that when I started the research for this episode, when I thought about feminist fashion, I thought about slow fashion.
Yeah.
I thought about sustainable fashion.
Ethical consumption of where you're purchasing things from.
But what does that mean in a globalized system where you cannot control all aspects? Where do you live your values in such a diffuse system? I don't know. But I do know that the people who are going to be suffering the most are not going to be affluent white women.
Yes.
They are not going to be the Devil Wears Prada editor-in-chief of whatever that magazine was that I can't remember now to save my life.
I can't either. Sorry, Sandra Bullock.
It wasn't even Sandra Bullock. Wait. It was Meryl Streep.
Oh my God. I've never seen Devil Wears Prada. I'm going to be real with you. Shit. I'm so sorry.
Lucy.
I'm so okay. Sorry.
So and we all know what Lucy's take home assignment is going to be for this.
That's my call to action for this episode. Is watch Devil Wears Prada.
Well, thinking about the systems of exploitation and yes. Who is being marginalized and whose voice is not even being included in the conversation. You know, Anna Wintour is the editor of Vogue. Did you?
Yes.
Did you
know I do that? Know this. I do know
okay,
this.
Just making sure. I don't know. But I can guarantee you that Anna Wintour decides that cerulean is the color of the season or whatever the color of the season is right now. And it's not going to be her that suffers the harm of an over farmed land,
mm-hmm.
of chemicals that are causing problems in factories, of just a bunch of shit, man. And it's hard when you live in a globalized society. And I want to make clear that we're not, how do I put this? We're not saying all of this because we want you to feel bad, but because shame is not a tool for progress.
No, we use compassion to call people into this conversation with us.
And think about, you know, what can we do to live our values as intersectional feminists who want this world to be better for the future, whether it's your children or my children or your favorite friend's children, because you don't have to have children for you to care about the world, or just because you want it to be better because you're not a dick. Like, what can we do to live those values? Interesting things, though. Let's talk about some examples of fashion. And so there's one thing that I definitely want to bring up.
Yes.
There was a huge, huge case where the Navajo Nation sued Urban Outfitters in a trademark suit. Because Urban Outfitters, if you've never been, we don't recommend buying
from them. We don't stand them in this household because you don't steal from other cultures.
They are appropriators in just the worst fucking way. And they never really face consequences for their actions.
Ever.
But the Navajo Nation, which is the largest Native American tribe in the United States, settled a trademark suit against Urban Outfitters over the use of the tribe's name and company merchandise. So there were two brands in Urban Outfitters called Navajo and Navajo with an H-O at the end, which we're just going to put a pin in that.
We're
going
to put
later.
A little pin in that, which I don't want to even try to assume what they're attempting to get at or imply.
No.
Conversation for another day.
Yeah. And so they used those two brands' names, right? Navajo and Navajo with an H-O at the end, in a variety of products, including pullovers, feathered earrings, and underwear. Well, in 2012, Navajo leaders filed a suit in the U.S. District Court of New Mexico that the retailer had infringed on the tribe's trademark rights by selling more than 20 lines of product under those two brands' names. So the case was settled in November 18th of 2016. So it took 4 years.
2016.
Yeah. It took 4 years for the case to get settled. And the terms of the settlement were not made public. And based on my research, I could not find anything that kind of illuminated that. But the Navajo Nation president at the time, Russell B. Gay, said, "We believe in protecting our nation, our artisans, designs, prayers, and way of life. We expect that any company considering the use of the Navajo name or designs or motifs will ask for our permission." As part of the settlement, the one part of the settlement that was made public was that the Navajo leaders said that the two parties had also signed a supply and license agreement, and plan to collaborate on authentic American Indian jewelry in future years. So when we consider the real life impact of fashion and feminism, right, and intersectional feminism, think about cases like these, where a group, an indigenous group, a Native American group that had been stolen from yet again. First we take their land.
And then we take their culture and treat them like objects because we're using their symbols and likelihood without even asking.
Because they don't need to be asked, right? They're just here for our consumption.
Nope. Just get to take.
And Urban Outfitters probably made more money off of the sales of those 20 products under those two licenses, like those two lines, than anything that they paid out in the settlement.
Oh, 100%.
By the Navajo Nation seizing and forcing them to sign a supply and license agreement. You know, this is how, by thinking about fashion as more than just something you're interested in because it's pretty, but as an actual actionable item, now it's going to be part of the sustainment of the Navajo tribe for just years to come. And also think about, oh my gosh, when we're thinking about stereotypes, going back to that briefly, France and Quebec denying women the right to wear the hijab or the niqab and being like, no, this is against our Western ideals of what fashion for women should be. And you're being oppressed and we're going to save you from that oppression.
They're so high and mighty in that culture to believe that, like, they pass these laws, right, that say we are not going to allow any form of religious expression in public, especially it targeted schools, very specifically. But then again, they're still practicing like evangelical and Christian ideals in schools. Like they put up trees at like Christmas time, but because they don't see that as like some oppressive symbol, but they're imposing their own views that the hijab is some oppressive figure that they are freeing students from, and especially imposing that at a young age then.
You know what also drives me nuts about it too is that it's such a white knight kind of.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need you to be my superhero, Western liberal ideas of what is right or not.
White people don't need to free anyone else from anything, saying this as a white person.
I'm cool with that. And there was a similar issue in 2016 in the United States. So this professor called Larisha Hawkins agreed to step down from her job at Wheaton College, an evangelical school in Wheaton, Illinois, because she wore a hijab in solidarity with her Muslim coworkers. And that led to everybody getting like chastised, and you know, it was against the terms of their employment with Wheaton College because there was an evangelical Christian university and blah blah blah. Students protested, students fasted, students tweeted against her. Donors, parents, alumni were in an uproar saying that this was shameful and not something that she should be doing. And I just, fashion is political and politicalness is personal. And I think that's the moral story of just this whole episode, is when you think about fashion, critique it.
On every aspect.
Yeah, on every single aspect. Understand what ingrained biases you have towards fashion, and think about how you can best live your values while not striving for perfection, because that's a tool of white supremacy and just bullshit in general.
And it's just impossible to achieve.
Yeah. There should be nobody striving for perfection anyway, I think.
No. Because then that erases progress and conversation.
Yes, like this one.
Like this one. We wouldn't be having this conversation if we were both perfect.
If every pork chop were perfect, there wouldn't be hot dogs.
There would not be hot dogs.
Shout out to Rebecca Sugar, our favorite cartoonist.
My fave non-binary cartoonist.
an icon. They are an icon. Just a whole icon.
A whole icon.
So that's our call to action for this episode. Think about how you view your fashion. Think about your art piece and what you want it to say. And make sure that your art piece is speaking for you and not for somebody else's ideals. But otherwise, that's it. That's what we've got. Lucy, where can people find you on the social medias?
People can find me at Lucy Grace with 4 E's tacked onto the end across all social media, because I do love to be consistent in how people find me.
Oh, bless. And you can find me, Natalia, at Nat Van Paul on Twitter, or at Stitchcraft N Wizardry on Instagram, because I think that being consistent is also a tool of the patriarchy. Yep.
Listen. Listen, right at the end, gotta call me out.
Lucy, part of your homework will also be to watch The Devil Wears Prada.
Perfect.
You know, and we should tear that down from a non-binary lens, because I would be fascinated to hear what you think about that movie as a wonderful icon.
I will give you all my thoughts on it.
This is great. And also tweet at Lucy. Remember, at Lucy Grace with 4 E's. If there are any other fashion movies that they should watch.
Please do. Please do. I'll keep a running list.
All right, folks. Well, it was so glad to talk to you. And we hope that you are having a great day. And we'll catch you on the next page.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.